Like I said, the transition between Gates to Bulma and then Bulma to Satya Nadella. Nadella.
Here we have it. Episode 46 of Bad Voltage. Welcome to the show. What have we got on this show, Mr. Langridge?
Well, on this particularly short show, this time, it is, really. First, we're going to talk about Google and the variety of services they provide and how our very own Brian Lundig has decided to step away.
We'll also discuss what the Linux landscape might look like when Linus is gone.
And then John O'Bacon will review a grill.
Okay, sell it, brother.
A large grill.
Really,
it's
really
a big
large
grill.
It's
a very
silver,
nice grill.
I believe, correct?
Yep.
Silver.
And it's made out of asbestos. Anyway.
On that fine note, and now, Bad Voltage. So recently, Linus went on vacation and took a little break from Linux, and that kind of brought up a few articles that I know a bunch of us have seen about what kind of the Linux landscape would look like after Linus goes away, whether it be retiring or something, you know, the proverbial gets hit by a bus or whatever it may be. How would that impact kind of the future direction of Linux? And how really does that compare to something like Jobs leaving Apple or the succession of CEOs that they've had at Microsoft? You know, so how would those compare and contrast, and what would Linux really look like without Linus? So I don't know if you guys, what are your guys' thoughts on that?
There was quite a lot of, when the article started popping up about what would Linux look like without Linus, it was all very much focused on, oh my God, it'll be a disaster. And then people came back and went, no. Because look, Greg KH take over this thing and whatever. And there does seem to be, although there's not a kind of an official continuity plan, it doesn't look like anything would crater. But it's interesting if you look at big companies like, you know, Jobs dying and Tim Cook taking over at Apple, the Ballmer leaving and Satya Nadella taking over at Microsoft, how much it's changed the culture of those companies. And would that happen with the Linux kernel? Oh. And would that make a difference to desktop Linux users, right? I mean, Mark Schall will still be running Ubuntu, right? Regardless of who.
That's a really, kind of interesting point. Yeah, that's an interesting point, Stuart. I mean, my guess is the first thing that would happen is the Linux kernel mailing list would probably have a lot more profanity in it, maybe some abusive behavior where people kind of make fun of each other. This could get really rough in a hurry.
I don't believe that would happen necessarily. And
I see what you did there, Brian.
Do you like that?
Subtle. Yeah, very subtle. That.
Yeah. The kernel is, because it's it certainly sees itself as being a very technical only focused environment. So that aspect of it probably wouldn't change. You wouldn't see patches getting rejected before where they were being accepted now, or vice versa.
Right.
I suspect the culture on the list would change quite a bit. But do you think that would filter through to the rest of the free software community or not? I mean, how much of a difference would it make if Linus did decide to knock it all on the head and become a diving instructor?
Well, let me ask you a question on the kernel specific, and I'm a bit embarrassed that I don't know the answer to this. So is there, like, I've never really seen a strong opinionated direction for the kernel. It's not like, I never see like Linus posting the State of the Union kind of type post where he says, in the next 6 months, we're going to go after this and do this and do this. It seems like the kernel is very much, it's almost like a clearinghouse of technology. Like people show up and they propose
it's very
additions
grassroots
and changes.
Yeah,
yeah, right. I was going to say, whereas, he doesn't lead a top down like that, but there's definitely a lot of very opinionated discussions that he has where he'll reject a patch because he doesn't like how that specific thing is done. So anyone any company is free to submit a patch or a feature, you know, to the kernel. So it's definitely not a top-down development in that way, but he definitely makes a lot of very opinionated decisions.
But that was my impression was that anything goes so long as it's done really well.
Well,
he'll allow additions and changes and new drivers as long as it's done well. Whereas with a lot of projects, a lot of companies, you have, like, comparing it, for example, to Shuttleworth, he has the big, like, this is what we're going to do kind of vision.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that the reason why Linux would survive easier would be because Greg KH can do broadly the same thing that Linus does, whereas that kind of, like, charismatic visionary, when that person's missing, it changes the dynamic for
Linus has
company.
Very opinionated, very strong opinions on individual topics, but I don't think that those opinions form part of an overall strategic direction. So you could go, I mean, if you look at the thing where getting Microsoft to sign binary so they can be booted with secure boot, and the way that happened was with an X509 certificate and a patch was submitted to the kernel to say, and right. Now this allows the kernel to read X509 certificates, and Linus was like, no, because that's a fucking stupid way to implement this. It was a perfectly technically good patch. It served a real world need, but Linus was like, we're not doing it this way. I hate it. We're not doing it. And that's definitely an opinion-based thing. It's not just, you know, I don't like the quality of your code. It's I don't care about the quality of code. We're not doing it this way. But there's not any kind of overall strategic direction into which all these puzzle pieces fit and build towards. Unlike someone like Mark, who has a big picture, and then decisions that are made are made at least partially based on how far they advance you towards achieving the big goal.
Yep.
Right. I think Linux doesn't really need that, though, right? Ubuntu is a product, and it has areas that they want to go with that product, where the kernel's not really a product. It's an infrastructure piece to a lot of other products, so it doesn't need that. There is no one cohesive vision for the Linux kernel, because it's used in so many different ways by so many different people that that's just not a thing.
Yeah.
It's actually thinking about, I've never really thought about this before, that given the age of the project now, given how long Linux has been built, I'm actually pretty astonished that it's retained that same sense of grassroots. Because a lot of projects, when they get big, they get successful, they become dominant by another process. So we saw that with OpenStack. Like, when OpenStack suddenly became this big piece of cloud infrastructure, the way that project was managed became quite different as opposed to...
And I think a lot of that credit does go directly to Linus. I know a lot of people think he's abrasive, and a lot of people think that he spits too much vitriol at times. But I think that the one thing that would change without him is that there'd be a lot of committees instead of him, and that would slow the pace of adoption down, I think, more than people maybe realize. Because right now, Linus is the decider, for lack of a better word. And if that decider was a committee, then you'd have all kinds of corporate politics going on. And he's been pretty good at staying out of corporate politics, if nothing else. Where if you had a committee now with IBM and Red Hat and a bunch of corporate entities making decisions in a committee-type fashion, the development of the kernel would change real quick. To Stuart's question, though, I don't think Linux end users would notice it for a decade. I mean, it's just...
Right.
Yeah, I agree.
I think is kind of an interesting point that it's not going to filter through to things. But I wonder when you said about OpenStack as an example, I wonder how much of that is because there's money involved. As soon as a thing becomes a product, as soon as you've got some people who want to sell it for some reason, you then get into essentially a tug of war between this looks better to customers and this looks better technically, and the kernel. They go, we're going to do what looks better technically. If everyone stops using it tomorrow, then that would be sad, but we don't actually care that much. Or at least that's the impression they attempt to project about the way they make decisions. Whether it's the truth or not is another question. But if you're OpenStack and you say, well, we could do this thing which is technically best, but we have deadlines to meet and customers to satisfy, so we'll do this other thing instead. And there isn't that tension in the kernel because it's not a product.
Right.
Yeah. And I'd say part of it is just there is a difference between the, I don't know what the correct term would be, like just the aggregated technology clearinghouse, you know, a place where you basically add more and more pieces onto it, so long as it's excellent quality like the kernel, or whether it's, you know, it is whether you sit down and you have, you know, a bunch of discussions first and you get you know, agreement on the strategy, and then you move together on it. And you know, you can't really run a company very well like the former, but you have to like the latter in many ways, right? Which is why the Linus situation, it might be unique. It might be unique where Linus could get hit by a bus, sadly, and the project would go on and succeed. But what about other open source projects? I mean, what about, for example, LibreOffice? I mean, a pretty big open source project. seems to be a lot more strategy involved in that. Like, I think they say what they want to go out and achieve and what they want to accomplish. What about
Razer FS?
Well, the key thing you said there about LibreOffice is that is you use the word they. There is no one obvious person who were they to be hit by a bus. There would then be no strategic direction.
Right.
I don't even know who's at the top of the tree for a LibreOffice.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Does anyone know? So, you can't go, Hillary what Clinton. If this person you've never heard of who does... I mean, someone who does a lot of work on LibreOffice suddenly being unavailable to do so would be problematic, but it wouldn't mean yeah. the strategic direction changes. It just progress towards it slows down a lot.
Right.
So what about another example? What about everybody's favourite Hobbit, Dan Foray, from The Elementary Project?
Are we really calling Daniel Foray of The Elementary Project a Hobbit? I have no personal knowledge as to his height or like his limb proportions to the rest of his body. I've never met him in person, so I can't speak to his gnomish or hobbitishness.
To be
se.
Clear, it's a completely baseless joke. Just seemed right at the time. So I'm sorry, Dan.
But that's actually a really good comparison, I think, here.
It is.
Because in the same way with the kernel, you have Linus is clearly at the top, right? And lots of other people run their own kernel trees and you can choose to use them, but it's clearly Linus's thing. And were he to leave or be unavailable or die or whatever, I'm sure a lot of people would kind of point at Greg KH and go, he's the new Linus.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people would be more like, well, I'm not sure there should be a new Linus because I'm not sure it should be Greg. Maybe it should be me. And maybe a few of us should get together. And working out right. that transition between there is one person who decides and there are a few people who decide will be interesting. And Elementary is the same thing. I mean, yes, there are other people involved in the project. I'm sure if Dan Foray decided to bail tomorrow, then Cassidy could pick it up and what have you. But it's kind of Dan's thing in the same way. He would probably deny that, but it is.
Well, it's, you know, and as we're pulling out lots of examples, it's also kind of another interesting comparison is Kubuntu, because Jonathan Riddle has said repeatedly he doesn't consider himself to be a leader. Right. However, people see him as a leader.
Yeah.
And... Right. I would imagine that Dan would have a similar kind of perspective on Elementary. He's kind of like the spiritual leader of the project, even though he will acknowledge...
He's the shaman, yeah.
He will acknowledge that lots of other people play a role in delivering Elementary, but and if somebody like that left, I mean...
I think a big difference when you're comparing something like Elementary with something like the Linux kernel is the longevity, right? Because that project is still very much getting off the ground and establishing themselves, losing your leader at that time is just a different discussion than something as entrenched as a 20-year project. Right? They're just going to always be two different things. If Linus would have stopped doing Linux at year one or two, then obviously this is a much, much, much different discussion.
But it's not, but it's not the longevity of the project. It's the longevity of Linus's leadership of it. Because, I mean, if you look at, like I said, the transition between Gates to Ballmer and then Ballmer to Satya Nadella on Microsoft, they were, Microsoft have been around for 40 years now, but each individual CEO has only been there for a certain amount of time. And there's been this quite serious cultural shift as a new person comes in and says, no, we're going to think about these things in a different way than we did before.
I'm sure that would happen. I mean, I'm sure it would happen. You have new leadership, even if the new leadership, it really all he is just the final guy that accepts the patches for the Linux kernel, right? If that's Greg KH and he takes over Linus's responsibility, I mean, realistically, that's going to have an impact. He's going to let some things through that Linus wouldn't, and he's going to reject some things that Linus probably would have accepted. So the overall quality and direction of the kernel would undeniably change at least a little bit, even if that wasn't the intention. It's just going to happen. I don't think it's something like we need to worry about, like, you know, it going off in some crazy direction, like all of a sudden, you know, the Linux kernel is closed source and is owned by Oracle or something crazy like that. I mean, the whole Linux community has been pretty ardent and militant about trying to fund, like, through the Linux Foundation and whatnot, to keep the kernel kind of its own separate entity as much as possible. And I that'll probably just keep on going because so many people have a vested interest in seeing it to be so. But I'm sure it would change. I mean, well, I would like to think that Greg would be awesome and step into those shoes and start whipping out the F-bombs a little bit more frequently on the mailing list and start really just putting people in their place to keep that good sort of vibe going that I've really come to appreciate from Linus. But, you know, if he's nicer, that's okay, too.
Well, the terrible, thing about Linux as well
terrible
is...
terrible vibe. Here's the thing. As a comparative point, something John and I said, coming up with different examples, think about the Free Software Foundation without Stallman.
Oh, that's going to be a whole different
deal. That sounds wonderful.
I've thought about this a bunch of times in the past. I'm almost certain what's going to happen here when he... First of all, he'll never step down. He will always be in that position.
He'll be there till he dies.
Yes. It's a lifelong commitment.
I would say he's like the Pope never stepping down, and then a Pope stepped down and completely blew that argument out of the water. I'm really disappointed.
But when he, you know, God forbid when it happens, when he passes away, when Stallman passes away, he is going to be he'll go from being a guy to being a symbol and an icon.
Like, yeah.
He will take on an almost Jesus-like presence to Free Software fans.
He will.
As opposed to nearly a Jesus-like appearance as he has at the moment.
But that's a whole different thing though. I mean, because that those sorts of symbols can be really beneficial if they stand for good things and stand for freedom. It doesn't matter what you think of the guy when the guy's alive. There's so many examples throughout history of people who were a little bit shifty who turned out to be really great symbols after their death that motivated some great change in the world. So that's fine. So even if Linus
like
gets
Gandhi. Like Gandhi, like Mother Teresa.
Yeah,
those two.
Those jerks, right?
I mean, those are like great symbols afterwards, turned out kind of assholes.
Yeah, turns out. So I don't know. I think honestly, and this is the wrong thing to say during the end of this discussion, but I think the whole discussion is stupid and pointless because we don't actually know and there's nothing we can predict about it. It could go crazy. Honestly, if Linus tomorrow wakes up and goes, you know what? I'm going to be a scuba instructor. Screw you guys. I'm done with this. Walks away. Things could go nuts. I mean, this could really go nuts. We could see 5 or 6 different forks of the kernel. We could see corporate battles over it. We could see craziness ensue, or nothing at all really could happen and it could be great and the wonderful people that are already working on it could do a great job.
So a separate question then, is it a little surprising considering the billions of dollars involved with the Linux kernel and just how much, you know, economic output there is, but just how much social good output there is based on Linux? Is it weird that there isn't a contingency plan?
Yes, a little bit.
Oh, well, I think people would say that there is one. I mean, the kernel's never going to go unfunded. Things like the Linux Foundation exist to ensure that kind of thing is the case and to pay for kernel.org and what have you. But as Brian says, as there's not really much more you can do in terms of contingency plan.
You can't say
we will anoint someone as a new Linus because not everyone's going to agree to that plan.
That would change over time, obviously. I mean, if you would have picked the new Linus 15 years ago, it would have obviously been probably Alan Cox. If you would have picked it 10 years ago, it would have obviously been someone who isn't Greg Cage. And if you picked it now, it would probably obviously be Greg Cage.
I like to change. It goes from Alan Cox to, and then Greg Cage.
Alvero, maybe, or...
for a little time, it probably would have been Marcelo Testa. It would have been different people, is my point.
I feel really bad for those guys between Alan Cox.
Well, it probably would have been Marcelo for a while. It probably would have been someone else.
The hidden generation.
But I can't remember who was the most prominent second in, you know,
Linux kernel left out
for every 1 year rolling iteration for the last 20 years.
Of course you're not. Of course you don't remember it because their lives had no meaning. So
they had so much. They had so much meaning. It probably would have been Rick Van Ryle for a while, but it would have been a lot of different guys. Is my point.
Now you're just making up names.
But I think that if there was a plan that Linus was on board getting behind, the likelihood of there being a schism after would be lower, where if it happened out of the blue, I think a lot of different organizations would try to take it in a lot of different directions, which would cause some level of, as John O loves to say, a fracas.
I
think that's where the contingency plan would come in.
The I'm almost certain that there is a contingency plan that we just don't know about.
I'm guessing Jim Zemlin's got like an encrypted file somewhere where he can pop it open and it's got all of the keys, all of the passwords, all of Linus's stuff that he needs for someone else to take over and final will and testament for the Colonel only or something like that.
Given the amount of money that's poured into it and given the fact that the Linux Foundation obviously... I mean, they've done a really nice job, like stewarding a lot of the business to support Linux and in lots of different ways. It wouldn't surprise me at all if at some point Jim Zemlin has said, Linus, we have to think about this. Like if something does happen, and that there may be like the equivalent of a will that if Linus gets hit by a bus or something like that, that it basically says, Greg, you're going to take
suddenly
over,
Tova is in charge.
Or even that Jim Zemlin or the Linux Foundation will work through a certain process to identify the next logical leader. There's got to be something in place, to some extent,
because Linux is the way it is, because the kernel is the way it is, it's all open source and everything, there's slightly less need for a kind of continuity of government plan, right? If you believe the Koch people and there are only two people who know the full recipe or whatever, and both of them die, that's the end of the company. But if Linux, you know, disappeared tomorrow, it's not like everyone goes, oh shit, now we haven't got the source code because he had the only key, damn it, what are we gonna do now, right? at that point, Jeremy, you can stand up and go, right, okay, Linux now belongs to Linux Questions, and here is the git feed.
I think that's natural path.
Anyone could do that tomorrow or today.
Those of you who follow me on some kind of social network may be familiar with the fact that I rather like barbecue. I love smoking ribs, pulled pork, brisket, and more. In fact, I smoked a pork shoulder last night. Now, despite many hours of learning how to smoke, I still suck mightily at grilling. So, this summer I decided to rectify this problem by buying a gas grill and learning how to use the damn thing. This is when I saw the NXR stainless steel 7-burner gas grill from Costco, available at the princely sum of $800 in store. Now this thing is a monster. It's got 7 burners, it's measured at 80,000 BTU, it has a side burner, searing plate, rear heating plate, motorized rotisserie, warming drawer with 2 containers, ice drawer, headlights inside the grill, and LED lights above the controls. Oh, and it comes with a cover too. This is a lot of grill for the money. Similar specs can weigh in at upwards of $2,000, so how good is it? Also, who the hell is NXR, and did they make this thing out of cardboard and sticky tape? Let's start with the burners. Overall, they're pretty good. They don't really get sear hot, but they're as hot as most typical grills. I temp checked all of the different burners, and the right side of the grill is generally cooler than the left, and the rear part of the grill is hotter. I have read, though, that you can take the flame bridges off and balance the temperature across the front and back burners. The searing plate was a major attraction for me, and it's important for searing steaks. This thing is about as hot as the surface of the sun. My infrared thermometer couldn't even measure it was so hot, so it easily gets over 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The only downside is that the searing plate is either on or off. There's no middle ground, so using it requires some trial and error. The rotisserie looks great, but honestly I haven't had a chance to use it yet, but it comes with a rotisserie rod, skewers, and motorized control. The side burner is, well, a side burner. It does exactly what you expect. The heating drawers are nice, great for beans and other sides, and the drawer is powered by a dial to vary the temp. The ice drawer is great for storing meat or beers, and also there's a little drawer for keeping grilling tools in. The grill itself is built like a tank. It doesn't feel like a cheap grill and feels about as rugged as a Weber. The LED lights above the dials look awesome. They add a futuristic blue color, and the headlights inside the grill are handy for night grilling too, which I'm often doing. Cooking-wise, this thing is awesome. There is plenty of room for feeding a large crowd, and it's deep enough to get a pizza stone in it. The variance in temperature across the grates is to be expected with any grill, and the NXR doesn't seem any worse than most grills, although I obviously haven't tested this extensively. The searing plate was one of the major attractions here, and it rocks. I throw a steak on there for about a minute on either side, and it really locks those flavors in while I finish the steak on some cooler grates. I just wish the searing plate was a little wider. Doing the 45 degree switch to get diagonal grill marks is a little tough due to how narrow it is. In terms of downsides, well, there's a few. While the whole thing is gas powered, the headlights inside the grill and the heating drawers do need power. I understand that for the drawers, but for the lights, well, they could have been battery powered like the LED lights. The on-off nature of the steering plate could also benefit from a variable setting. And finally, the cover, weirdly, has gaps in it where the controls are, and this could let water in underneath the cover. These, though, are small limitations for the sheer range of features and quality on offer here. So, what is the bad voltage verdict? If you want a grill that packs all the features you'd ever need and you're on a budget, the NXR is a great choice. Get a friend though, because this monster weighs a ton.
That was beautiful, my friend. That was just beautiful.
Not as beautiful, I imagine, as watching him try to load that thing onto a truck to get it home. I suspect that was the most beautiful thing about the entire purchase.
It was an inelegant sight, I have to say.
I'm starting to think that the most beautiful built thing might be the bills afterwards. I mean, if this thing puts out 80,000 BTUs, it must use a shocking amount of gas, and you have to plug it into the mains as well.
Well, it doesn't actually, I mean, I've only used it a little bit, obviously, and it doesn't actually seem to use all that much gas. It doesn't seem any more of a gas guzzler than the shitty little grill that we had previously. But like I said in the review, the plugging into the mains really is only for the heating drawers and for the LED lights. So, you know, I plugged it in once because the only time I've ever used it's been light outside and I've not used the heating drawers yet. It seems so stupid that those lights just battery powered.
You could pretty much just derive enough heat to keep the heating drawers warm from the heat from the rest of it, right?
That's a good point. Yeah, maybe.
You know, put a very tiny gas turbine in it somewhere, which actually generates electrical power, but that's probably a bit too much whizziness.
There's a reason why you don't make grills.
Yes.
I'd be brilliant at it, though. Let's bear this in mind.
I will say, for the amount of money, that is a lot of grill, because I do have a Weber Genesis, I think it's like the E320 or something like that, which is roughly the same price and has almost none of the extra stuff that thing has, and I think is like 42,000 BTUs.
What was the price again, Jono?
It was like, I forget exactly. It was either $800 or like $850. Somewhere around $800.
That's
$800,
not bad,
and that's in store
for a monster of a grill like that. That's not bad.
Seven grills.
So
right, yes. Looking at the picture online, that thing looks giant.
It does. It looks huge.
It's monster. And if you buy it from the Costco website, it's like an extra $200, $250, which I'm assuming is primarily just for the shipping, because this thing weighs like 260 pounds.
I wonder if you can get that on Amazon Prime. That'd be awesome.
How many?
So I bought the Weber Genesis on Amazon, and they delivered it for free using
Prime. Are you kidding me?
Really?
No, they shipped a whole freight, damn grill? So
it wasn't 2 days, to be fair. They shipped it freight, and the Weber is not nearly as gigantic as that thing, but it's still a pretty big grill. But they did ship it.
So shipped it for free. I bought a micro SD card off of Amazon. They charged me £2 shipping.
that's horrible. I once knew a friend who bought a giant, one of those like Costco size packs of toilet paper. You know, those huge size of a man packs of toilet paper. Shipped it for free. I mean, it only weighed like 3 pounds, the whole box. But I swear to God, you could have fit an entire refrigerator in there. And Amazon shipped that sucker for free. I have a couple of things on this review, Jono.
Yeah.
First, I would like to muster up some sort of barbecue elitism and tell you that charcoal is better or something like that. But the truth is, that actually sounds like a pretty badass grill. So I'm going to skip over that entire point entirely. Second, I am very proud of you for this review. In the first few sentences, you made so many double entendre sexual innuendos that it made my mind spin. The words like smoked and sucked and rectified just rolled off your tongue with such ease and grace that I'm very proud of you.
Well, you know what? It's every time when I was writing the review last night, every time I typed the word pork in, I thought, I have to say pork shoulder because of the people who I record this show with.
I don't know that the word shoulder saved it any.
Given that you have, we've explicitly asked people to excerpt interesting bits from the show, having Jono saying, I smoked some pork last night is probably not something you want taken entirely out of context and made its own little MP3.
I would profoundly disagree.
More serious question. The searing plate. Right, I used to have one of those on my the oven in my house right before I moved, and I think they're dead handy. But from listening to Jeremy and his magic boil in the bag sous vide thing, and then you just blowtorch the shit out of the thing at the end.
Yeah.
Do we actually need searing anymore? Searing plates, I mean, rather than just doing the blowtorch thing.
Good question. I mean, I've never used sous vide before, so I don't know.
So
I mean,
you could use the Searzol, obviously, without a sous vide. It's in no way tied to the sous vide.
That,
so
was,
you could,
that was the name of it, Searzol. Yeah, you could, I couldn't remember the
use
name.
It just to sear anything. And I have actually used it to sear. I've actually used it to cook things because salmon I like very, very rare. So I'll just sear it with the Searzol without having cooked it in the sous vide. So you could certainly replace it.
With the Searzol. Even by the standards of people who eat rare stuff. That's challenge. Presumably, if you stick it on the plate and don't eat it quick, then it eats all your vegetables before you get a chance to.
Well, you got to be quick.
You just show it a framed picture of a grill.
Exactly. You know, as long as someone somewhere in the building is having a cigarette at the time, that's rare enough. Jesus.
The searing plate thing was pretty cool. I mean, the first time I used it, I did some looking on Google to see, you know, I wasn't sure how long, because I didn't know what the temperature of this thing was. I didn't know how long you sear for. And, of course, with a steak particularly, the margin of error with a steak is pretty small. Like a bad steak and a good steak is like a minute out. And this thing amplifies that. So doing it a minute on either side seemed to be it. But what I was surprised at was I didn't get like the really thick grill marks, but I don't think I left it to warm up like fast, like long enough. So,
I'm surprised it even took as long as a minute with something that hot. I mean,
I am too, actually.
I like you say, I mean, this is the point that Jeremy was making when he was talking about the sous vide stuff, that if you get a steak and cook it for slightly too long, then it's bloody charcoal, especially if things are operating at 1,000 Fahrenheit. I mean, for God's sake, that's like being on a star. That's really hot.
That is very hot.
Well, that's another, I mean, that would suggest that I didn't leave it long enough. I mean, I left it for about probably 10 minutes, but...
And it's gas.
This thing glows red immediately. So, wow. I mean, this thing glows red immediately. So I guess the searing plate could get hot, but it's waiting for the grill to heat up, which is obviously the thing.
So the central question then is obviously, who needs this? I mean, I'm sure it's fine if what you want to cook is, you know, you think, I like grilling, I like steaks, but I have this big need to do 11 at once. Then you buy this, right? But why would anyone who isn't trying to open up a barbecue shop in their backyard, why would they buy this?
It's actually not that much more significantly bigger than a lot of the grills on the market. Like if you go to, and I don't know what it's like in the UK, but in the US, you go to a Home Depot or something like that, and you see a bunch of these grills. It doesn't look significantly bigger in terms of the grill area. It's bigger in terms of the base because it's got like the heat
and
draws.
Wait. We need to stop for a second. Back up a little bit, Jono. Back up a little bit. You just said, I don't know what it's like in the UK, but in the US, when you go to a Home Depot, how the hell long have you been in the United States? Have you?
I was going to wait till he finished the sentence, but I was going to say the same thing.
I was astonished that you all left it as long as you did.
I have an aunt, and she's been living in the Netherlands for a little while, but she grew up in California, you know, went to college in California. Last time I saw her, she had the nerve to look at me, and she started to say, how do you Americans say, and pretended like she was trying to struggle to find this word in English, her native freaking tongue. I don't buy your crazy shenanigans. You got to own the country you come from, Bacon. Just live up to it. You know what the hardware stores look like.
Well, I would defend him fractionally, right? Even if Colonel Kurtz has gone completely native, I've been in hardware stores here, right? And this thing, I'm fine. Okay, so the grill's not that much bigger, but it's got 7 burners, but it's also got the side burner and the searing plate and the rotisserie thing and a heating plate and warming drawers. So I've lived in places smaller than that, right? Yes. This does not sound like a small grill.
I've never seen a gas grill in England before.
You only get little ones.
Really?
Yeah, never seen a gas grill. Like, you know the big freestanding things that we have in the US?
Yeah.
Never seen anything like that.
They are rare.
So does everyone use charcoal or everyone just doesn't grill?
People just don't grill very much.
Bit of both. Yeah, and when people do grill, they go out and buy like a little... It almost looks like one of those... You like one of those silver trays that you do a roast in.
What?
It's like that, and you put like a bit of charcoal on the bottom, and it comes to the.
So here is the thing: like a, sneering American really? People. This is like someone English going to America, then going, "I'd like a pint of bitter," and someone going, "Well, we don't really do bitter." You go, "What? Does everyone drink mild then?"
I don't understand at least three of the words you just said.
Different strokes.
I don't know that that's a super apt comparison, but fair point.
Yeah, it's worth the money by the sound of it, the thing.
Yeah, and like I say, it's not crazy big. I mean, I think anyone who's going to, and particularly in the US, I mean, people who are going to have a grill in the backyard for grilling on, you know, on a Sunday, inviting some friends over, it's designed for that. It just comes with extra stuff for, I mean, the rotisserie thing will be nice for doing chickens.
It does look kind of awesome.
So given something like the Weber Genesis at, I think it was more like $600 or this at $850, do you think the, I'm assuming slightly lower build quality, but significantly more features that you, given that you would choose this one again over something like the Weber, considering you just made that decision?
Yeah, I think so. And the one downside, the only thing that's a bit of a downside that I feel right now, but I don't have enough information to know whether this is the correct thing to think, is it feels like this grill, despite it being rated at 80,000 BTU, doesn't run as hot as some other grills. So I get the impression that, you know, the Weber grills, the high setting on a Weber will get higher. I went and temperature tested all of them, but I haven't had a chance to compare it to the other grills. Just because I didn't get really like deep searing marks in the steaks that I'd tried, but I've only really tried searing on the actual regular grill, on the regular burners once, and I don't think I let it heat up long enough. So, and also you have to like season grills, you have to break them in. It takes time for them to get to their ultimate grilling potential, but I definitely buy again. And the thing is, it being from Costco means that if anything goes wrong, you can take it back.
That is nice, right?
Costco, which is what it's all about.
Once you spend $275 hiring a truck, though, presumably, right?
Well, the fact that I never, ever want to move this thing again.
Do you just turn the rotisserie on and then have it push you down the road all the way to the thing? Do you know, by the way, true fact, right? Minnesota's state bird is the rotisserie chicken.
Is it really?
No.
Oh, man, because that'd be like,
but it'd be
going to
be badass, wouldn't it?
We'll edit that bit out.
Over the last several years, I've become increasingly reliant on everything Google. My operating systems predominantly are Android and Chrome OS, whereas before that, it was all various traditional Linux distros. I use Gmail for my email. I do everything in Google Docs. I'm sitting on a Google Hangout right now recording this freaking show. Basically, everything I do funnels through Google servers or is produced by Google's engineers. This got me thinking, what a horrible idea that is. So basically, I have one company, even a company that says don't be evil as one of their main mottos, having control of nearly 100% of all of my data. And we're talking music, movies, video games, documents, spreadsheets, slideshows, everything, as well as just the random files and crap I throw on Google Drive. Just seems like a bad idea. Google has a track record of, as do most companies, of killing off services when they feel they want to, they're just not cutting the mustard and the like. And well, what if something happens? What if their data center goes down? What if they get mega crazy hacked? What if they go out of business? I know that's not terribly likely with Google, but there's so many things that could happen that could just mean that I would literally be stranded in a wasteland of pre-1980s computer technology literally overnight if Google got wiped off the planet Earth. So I started a thing where over a 30-day period, which started, I think, about 12 days ago, I am removing every ounce of Googleness from my life over the course of a 30-day period, and then I'm going to spend another 30 days living a completely Google-free life. No Google-based software, no Google services, nothing. And I'm about 12 days into it so far, and it's really friggin' hard. I'm having a hell of a time with it. So I'm writing an article series on this over at Network World, and you guys can go read the articles if you like. I'm finding them kind of fascinating to go through this process, because basically I'm going down the list where first I got rid of Android, and first I got rid of Chrome OS, then I got rid of Android, then I got rid of Gmail, and now I got rid of Google Docs and Google Sheets and a couple other services and Google Drive. And now I'm moving on to other things like Hangouts and Google Voice and all the other services that I'm using on a constant basis. And it's astoundingly hard to get rid of all this.
I have a question for you. So
yeah,
in moving away from Google, is part of the goal here to see whether you can move away from a like a cloud-based service? Like, so if you went from Google Drive to Dropbox as one example, the Dropbox faces the same risk.
It's the same
going
risk,
away.
Right?
Well, so, are you trying to get away from clouds, or is it just Google?
It's twofold. Twofold. The first is diversifying the companies that you're reliant on, so making it so that there's not one single point of failure anymore. So, if I were to just say go from Google Drive to Dropbox, but use Google still for a lot of my other services, well, at least then I'm having, you know, some sort of a diversified infrastructure, different data centers, presumably different backbones. Different companies, you know, doing all this stuff. So it provides you a little bit of added security, where if lightning strikes one company and they just explode into a fiery ball of hell, well, at least Dropbox is still going, so I can still get it in some of my old Dropbox stuff. So that's one thing. The other thing is not just diversifying it, but trying to find ways to self-host where I can and kind of go that route. So like, for example, in getting rid of Google Drive entirely, you know, there's Dropbox, and that's good. But there's also things like own cloud self-hosting, and I could also go own cloud hosted by a hosting provider, which there's just like a thousand of. So I'm actually testing out self-hosting it and testing out having it hosted by a provider to kind of give people a sense of how much it would cost and how much time it would take them to replace a specific Google service with a self-hosted version of that service that you have to manage and control, which in the case of email would just be an absolute nightmare, or you know, how much it would cost you to pay a provider to give you that sort of thing, like Colab Now for email or one of the many own cloud providers, that sort of thing. So if you were to just trade Google for another cloud provider, I'm trying to document how much that would cost, how painful it would be, how well it would work out, what you would gain, what you would lose, all that sort of thing.
So this is actually, the more I thought about it, a really interesting question theoretically, right? Because on the one hand, Google clearly has eyes on your data, and what they're going to do with it long term remains to be seen. And being dependent, as you said, on any individual company really is scary when you think about the repercussions, especially how I think all four of us operate on a day-to-day basis. We're so dependent for our livelihoods on these things working that it is scary to be dependent on one company. And Google does have certainly a history of end-of-lifing products, sometimes with very little notice and sometimes kind of out of the blue, right? But on the other hand, moving away from Google realistically means either self-hosting or trusting a large number of much smaller and likely less technically capable companies. So net-net, it's probably not a privacy win. It's probably not a security win. It's probably not an anything win, because you then have to trust the weakest link, and the weakest
There's
link
more points
is
of entry.
Definitely
yeah.
less
Yeah, you're totally right.
Than Google. And hosting it yourself is, Google puts a lot of time and money and hires a lot of really smart people. And I would say that that makes it interesting, because I think the realization to me after thinking about this, knowing that we were going to do this topic, is that it's almost lose-lose, and that's disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, there is certainly an argument that what you should do is put all your eggs in one basket and then make sure it's a really, really good basket, which is to some extent what Google are doing for us, right? I mean, yeah, as Jeremy says, they have an army of site reliability engineers, all of whom are really good at their job, and they go to insane lengths to take care of this stuff. To my mind, this is not... I mean, yes, there's a certain amount of tinfoil hat, what if Google went evil or, you know, died, or Sergey just sold the company and spent all the money on sweets or whatever. But It's not so much about that from my point of view. The reason I think it's like
what
are
you envisioning? He's just buying like a lifetime supply of Laffy Taffy. Like what is
the thing here? I think you could get more than a lifetime supply of, you know, rhubarb and custard sweets if you sold Google and spent all the money.
Sergey can just chew through the Laffy Taffy, man. I don't know.
But the thing I think is interesting about this is looking at alternative providers for everything, not necessarily because, you know, what if Google go bad, but because about 4 or 5 years ago, I stopped looking for alternatives. Yeah, because Google did everything. Google did everything I wanted and does a good job at it. So if someone's doing a much better job of email or calendaring or whatever, I don't know about it. I haven't even missed. I mean, I've certainly seen a lot of people recommend things like Fastmail. And there's this kind of big inertia with, do I really want to set this up and pay a bit of money just to find out? And the huge hurdle of having to do the move in the first place probably burns any goodwill I'll have about them having a better service for the first 9 months. But if I can get Brian to burn all that goodwill and then go, it's a really good idea, do it, then making that move is a much more convenient thing to do.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you guys all just kind of nailed it. No one has said anything I've disagreed with so far. And I think the fact that I had the same thing with Stuart probably about 3 years ago, it got to the point where I'm predominantly on Google's servers and services and software. And every 6 months or so, they'd release a new update or a new service that made it even more compelling and more delightful. And I started loving it even more. And it was already inconceivable and horribly hard sounding to leave what they'd already had. And they kept making it better. And that to me frightens the crap out of me that I'm so entrenched in one particular set of services that I couldn't even imagine. It is devastating to think about the idea of leaving it all behind. And to me, that brought to mind correlations with more traditional operating systems. There are many people in this world, and this was more true, you know, some years back, but that would never dream of using anything other than Windows because all their software was on Windows. They were used to Windows. It was providing everything they needed. Was there a better way out there? For a lot of them, there totally was. And I think the four of us would all jump on board and agree with that. And the idea that they are stuck there is a horrifying idea. And so that's part of what is driving me to do this, is I have to break out now because Google's just going to make their products better. They really are. It's getting better all the time. And it's going to be harder to leave next year than it is this year. Yeah. So I need to do it now.
What's fascinating about that as well is exactly the 5-6 years ago, if we'd said to someone, hey, have you considered using Linux? You know, whatever your choice for Linux is. Have you considered using it instead of Windows? And they'd have said, no, because all my stuff's on Windows and I'm accustomed to it. We'd have said, well, those don't really seem like good enough reasons, right? Here are a bunch of other reasons why you might want to explore a bit more widely. Don't be so narrow-minded. And we've all kind of fallen into the same trap.
Exactly. That is not untrue.
You know what's weird about it is it's not just the services as well. Like when Brian first posted to Google Plus about this, I was like, the rest of us, we thought this is really interesting. Like the idea of you forget how all this Google kind of infrastructure kind of just builds up around you. And part of it is the identity. Like I use a bunch of different sites that aren't Google, and you know, they'll often provide an opportunity for you to log in with your Google account or with your Facebook account or whatever else. And it's, you know, I'm so fucking lazy that even just the idea of having registering an account and having to go through the whole email confirmation process, for me, it's just easier to click on that nice big red G.
Right? Click on the G and it's all done. Our forums, I log in with my Google credentials. So now here's an extra thing. Before my 30 days is up, I got to figure out how to transfer my account so I can log in, which is a normal login and password. I'm on our own damned forums.
I think conveniently,
so am I the only one? If given a unified login or a separate login, I always choose the separate login. Am I the only one of the four of us?
No,
you know.
Always. Unless I'm doing something explicitly tied to the service I'm logging in with. If someone puts up a thing which helps you edit your Google photos, I will then log in with Google. Yeah, if they're doing a thing which analyzes your tweets, I'll log in with Twitter. But I never use social logins. I create new accounts for everything.
See, I used to.
Because fuck that.
I'm the same as Jono. I used to be ardent about it. I had a system for my usernames and passwords relating to the sites that I felt was really tricky and awesome. And I had unique ones for everything. And then sometime, actually, it was around the beginning of this year, I just said, screw it. Click. I'm done. I'm just clicking on the G. And that to me is a sign that I have become lazy and just flaccid in terms of dealing with my own privacy and security. So this really got me thinking. So I got off of Gmail and I moved over to Colab now. So the Colab guys, right? And
those are the KDE. Those are the KDE folks.
Well,
right?
KDE. They got a lot. Aaron Seigel works for them, and they're based in Switzerland. Yeah. They've got a lot of nerd cred. They've got a lot of nerd cred. They do a lot of open source work, and they do a lot of work on Roundcube and stuff like that. So my thinking was, okay, if I'm getting off of Google services anyway, I'm not just going to go over to say a Dropbox or something with an owl on it. You know, I'm going to actually go out there and I'm going to put my money and time into the services where I feel like I'm getting an improvement in security and privacy in some way.
Right.
And at the same time, I also want to be, because this is my life and this is the crowd I live in, I want to be trying to support all of the free and open source projects and companies that I feel are really doing the best work. So like an email, after looking around and figuring things out, Colab Now was a very clear choice. It was inexpensive. They're easy to work with. They're crazy secure. They provide me their entire server stack is free and open source software that they provide to me. I can grab it, click a button, pull all my data down, and host my own Colab Now instance if I decide I don't want to be working with them anymore. So lots of things like that.
Do they provide a hosted web server, like webmail, like Gmail?
Yes, they do.
Oh, cool.
It's Roundcube based. So like I don't know if you guys saw the Kickstarter or Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign for the next version of Roundcube, which looks pretty nice, but they're the company behind that. They're the ones that are kind of driving that forward. So this isn't so much to promote these guys as to say there are more open source, more secure, and more privacy-focused services out there than Google. But it is they're kind of hard to find. They're kind of few and far between. And in some cases, you do have to make sacrifices in order to get them. So this has been challenging for me.
There's something to be said for Jeremy's contention that a smaller firm is not going to have as much expertise, as much time, and as much money to dedicate to keeping your stuff private. I agree.
Yeah.
But one of the nice things about using someone smaller is you get a much more personal touch. It's much more hard for them to fob you off with this corporate blank wall. I had all these problems with this YouTube video I uploaded where, you know, I got sued by content. Oh, I didn't get sued. I got contacted by the content ID
thing. You
got
flagged, yeah.
Yeah, yep. And then I appealed and then, you know, came back to me with, no, they've reappealed and there's nothing I can do about it. I can either compete it and get a copyright strike on my account, or I can give in and give them my ad money. And I can't talk to anyone about that. I mean, and I know people at Google and one of them looked into it for me and said, I'm sorry, there's nothing we could do. You just got to go through the process.
It sucks.
There's no chance at all, if you have a problem with Gmail, that you can pick up the phone and ring someone and talk to the engineers building it. And I'll bet money you could do that with Colab.
Oh, right. You absolutely can.
That's a weakness with Google in general, is that they have pretty much made every policy so that there's no human interaction step, even when at some points there needs to be.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There's something to me. I like that some of these other companies are a little more, not just smaller and personal, but a little more hungry. They're a little more driven. They need to prove that they can succeed. Like, so after I wrote, I can't remember, the second or third article in the series, or I think it was probably the second one. And I made mention at the end, I'm like, oh man, now I got to tackle Gmail because I just finished Chrome OS and Android. So I'm like, okay, Gmail's next. That's the next Google service I'm replacing. I got that day two different instant messages from people over at Colab, and Aaron Saigo dropped me an email of instant message, a couple other people. They're like, hey, so heard you want to get rid of Gmail, huh? Let me tell you why you want to use this one. And it wasn't so much a sales pitch as people who felt the same way I did talking to me about the things that they were passionate about. And it was almost like a sense of community that was instantly right there in that service. Yeah. And you don't get that with Gmail. There's no personalness. And Stuart mentioned something that is frightening the hell out of me right now. So this summer, I'm launching a new little video series, a kind of a short series of videos that I've been producing for a while. And if I'm getting rid of all these Google services right in the middle of the time that I was planning to launch these videos, which were going to go up on something called YouTube that is owned by Google, I now have to come up with a completely different way, not only to host them and make it a good experience, but hopefully to find some way to monetize it, or at least make it so I don't go bankrupt in serving up all the bandwidth for these videos. And this is proving to be incredibly challenging, because of course I could go over to something like the Daily Motion or something like that, where I really don't have a whole lot of control. But I don't want that. I want
Vimeo
to improve.
Can you not monetize with Vimeo?
You can, but I don't have a lot of experience with it. And again, it's just kind of trading an apple for Vimeo, a different kind of an apple. And so
I've used Vimeo a little bit, and they're really good.
Yeah.
And I think there are. They're nowhere near the size of Google.
No.
I don't think they're a tiny company, but they're smaller.
But I think that's the thing. Which car hire company was it who had the slogan, "We're number two, so we try harder"? It was either Lyft or Avis. But I think that is, a couple of months ago or so, so before Brian started this, I switched to using DuckDuckGo as my default search engine, right?
Yeah.
Now, I will concede that probably half the searches, I end up doing a search and then doing the search again with !! G on the end, which redirects it to a Google search, fine. So they're not great. But it's interesting to see different approaches. Like, they put video search at the top of all of their searches.
Yeah.
And since it turns out, probably 15 or 20% of the Google searches I do are looking for a song. And it's just super convenient to just do a search, bang, there it is, videos at the top, and just click on the one I want, done, with DuckDuckGo. And it's not necessarily that they're providing a better thing, they're just doing something differently. So Vimeo they'll try a bit harder than YouTube, and they're prepared to be slightly more decent to you in terms of money. They're prepared to offer features that YouTube couldn't offer at that scale, precisely because they are smaller.
I have a question, Brian, about yours. When you first started talking about it on G+, one of the first things I thought about was, what are you going to do about G+?
I was going to say, isn't there a certain irony to how ingrained you were that you decided to announce you're leaving Google services on a Google service?
To be fair, I don't just announce it there. I throw it up on Twitter and LinkedIn and everywhere else too. So here's how kind of how I look at Google+. I don't really rely on Google+. I kind of like it, but turning it off is actually not that hard, because there's all these other social networks that have, a lot of people. Now, a lot of the Linux people are living on Google+, which makes it kind of nice.
It seems to me that based upon watching the work that you do, you seem to get, at least as an external observer, the most traction. I see a lot more activity from you
way
on
more
Google+.
Engagement
because
Google+.
You have more of a technical audience there, and you're a technical journalist.
Yeah.
And so I would have imagined, yes, moving away from Google Docs to LibreOffice. Yes, moving from one email service to another. But the challenge is when you're depending on the audience, right? Like, people don't use YouTube just because it's Google. They use YouTube because
it's YouTube.
That's where people watch.
That's where they're
people
at.
Watch videos on the internet. So how are you going to do that when you've got to make. You've got bread and butter to take care of.
I mean,
this is
my problem. You're right. So I have, I can't remember how many followers, 8,000, 9,000 or so on Google+ and Twitter, about the same number. If I post the same content to both, I get way more traction and clicks over from Google+. And then on YouTube, I've got 10,000 some odd subscribers to my YouTube channel. Well, if I'm posting this stuff to Vimeo, that's theoretically 10,000 some people that weren't immediately alerted to it in order to help me make that video go kind of more virally, And so really it becomes more of a content distribution issue. And if I remove Google out of the equation entirely, I am absolutely unequivocally shooting myself in the foot for all of that. There's no doubt. There's no way to sugarcoat it. The question then becomes, is it worth it in the long run? Is it worth it for me to either self-host my content or to focus on the other social networks or to use a different service? Am I getting something out of that? And honestly, the answer is, I don't know. I don't know at this point. Part of this is just a test run. Part of this is a trial to see how it works. And I don't know how this is going to work.
Well, I think if I was in your position, the way I'd look at it was like, you've got data and then outreach. They're the two broad categories, right? So Google Docs, having all of your stuff in Google Docs, having all of your email in Gmail is one thing, right? Because if you lose, like, you've got one copy of that data and you know, invariably, and you don't want to lose that. Whereas at least the way I look at it, Twitter and LinkedIn, and
they're just promotional
Facebook
vehicles.
They're just promotional vehicles to one degree, and then there are another degree. Like, I use Facebook for keeping in touch with family and stuff.
They become chat rooms.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same argument that people like Rage Against the Machine use when someone says, "Well, if you're so opposed to the whole corporate America thing, why are you on Sony? What about that then?" And they go, "Well, they publish our records and more people get to hear them, right? We don't defend their business practices, but if we're trying to appeal to the masses." You've got to get the word out to the masses.
Where the masses are. Yeah. Well, let me ask you. I'm curious what your guys' thoughts on this. So, on the one hand, I would love to ditch the YouTube and Google Plus completely for completeness sake, because then I can say I literally removed every trace of the Googliness from my life. On the flip side, though, I do limit my audience. What do you guys think? Is it more worthwhile? And realistically, people on Google Plus are more likely to be interested in removing Google from their life than people on Twitter, because the people on Google Plus are like us, and a lot of them have had the exact same thoughts or tried to do the same thing and failed, which I keep hearing over and over again from people. So it seems like the people I need to get to are on those services.
Well,
I think it's a fair delineation
to Twitter
have
people.
Go ahead.
I think you can both go ahead.
Why don't you both go at the same time?
Presumably, people on Twitter already have removed Google from their lives, right? It's like me ringing you up and go, "You should remove Apple services from your life." You go, "Ta da, done, hooray!"
Right.
Next problem.
I was gonna say, I think it's fair to delineate on the creation versus consumption side, right? So, Gmail, you're consuming something, and Android, you're consuming something. On YouTube, you're really posting something for others to consume. So, you're limiting your own reach kind of with that.
Though a lot of the same problems with exactly what Stuart pointed out earlier, where he posts videos and then gets unfairly flagged for them and gets videos removed or gets disallowed from monetizing those videos. Those sorts of problems, if by moving away from Google as the distribution mechanism, you get rid of at least some of those problems. You might trade them for other problems.
Well, but if nothing else, I would say it would be fair to not limit yourself to the 30-day window, and while you're spinning up whatever you replace YouTube with, to use them both at the same time for some amount of time.
That, I think, is the point. I mean, I like Jono's distinction between data and outreach, and moving all your data off of Google services is something which is specific and private to you, which you can do unilaterally without affecting your business, and is a valuable thing to do. Outreach, I would see Google services in general as one channel to your audience. So instead of just saying, "I've done a video, I'll put it on YouTube and that's where it is," put it on YouTube and Vimeo or something. I mean, to take an example, when we did the Bad Voltage video, right? We put it on YouTube, obviously we did.
Yeah,
but I also put it on archive.org. And I did that precisely so if the YouTube people decide they want to kill it because we had Thunderstruck at the beginning of it, we've still got it. It's still backed up in the cloud, off-site, on a service that isn't run by us and therefore won't die if John and I are crap sysadmins like we normally are. Right?
Yeah.
So putting your video up on YouTube, I still think that's a worthwhile thing to do. Put it on Vimeo or Dailymotion or host it yourself or whatever.
I think you're right.
Because at that point, you've done most of the work you need to be aware that there's an alternative and properly engage with that alternative.
Here's why I keep coming back to I'm going to fully get myself off. Do you guys will ever watch, you know, like Man versus Wild or any of the Bear Grylls shows? Yep. Okay. When Bear Grylls goes out into the wilderness, right? You don't want to see Bear Grylls doing all the hiking, carrying the backpack, and mostly living off the land, except for the granola bars that he's got in his bag. And he keeps whipping out a chewy granola bar every now and then. You want to see him drinking his piss and eating some bugs. You want to see him doing it 100% of the way. You want to see that he can do it, not essentially do it, not get there and stop just shy of the goal, but he sees what it would take to get over the goal. You want to see him go over the goal and drink his pee. And
but that's kind of just carrying around all that modern technology, which wouldn't that be the equivalent of you posting it on YouTube? He's not doing it with no modern technology. He's carrying around a brand new camera.
No, that is true. But see, I can still use technology. It's just that I have to come up with a service that's not from this one company.
And well, there's the difference between whether this is intended to be a sideshow or whether it's something you're going to stick with, right? If it's just can Brian get off Google for a year, even? I don't think any of us would deny that you could do it, and your life wouldn't be significantly impacted. I think your career would be impacted a little bit because your audience wouldn't see half your stuff. But doing it in the long term, it seems like it will be inadvisable, particularly in the line of business that you were in. If you were just going to work every day and pulling in a paycheck, and you were just a guy that only the people who he works with knew, it'd be way different. But like, you're someone who part of your job is building your audience, right?
Yeah, it really is.
If you don't have an audience, you
don't have a job.
Don't have a career.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have nothing.
And given that Google today, I mean, I think we all agree that, you know, they're actually a pretty decent company in most cases.
In some ways,
they innovate. They're generally pretty reliable. Given how much they've grown, they've actually done pretty well.
They've done a very good job
striking the balance.
If they were doing a crappy job, this wouldn't be a problem right now. The fact is, they've already left. Yeah, I mean, come on. If they were crappy, we'd have gone. If they were really just taking all of our data and exposing it on a constant basis, none of us would be using it at all.
How much of a problem was it for you to get off ICQ? Not that big a problem.
So the big challenge before we wrap this up, I think, is going to be Google Hangouts. At least just when you first started talking about this, I thought, hang on a second, how are we going to record the show? Because for our listeners who don't know this, we record using a Google Hangout, and we could use something like Talky.io, which Ack introduced me to the other day, which works really great, but the difficulty is calling in guests, because we often call our guests in on a cell phone. So maybe someone's got an idea of an alternative service that we can use.
It will be harder. And, you know, I've thought about this long and hard. If I end up being the only thing I use Google services for is to hop on a Hangout once a week with you crazy guys,
I feel
like the internet will understand that I'm just simply not trying to incur the wrath of my co-hosts here. So I think that's okay. Honestly, the Google Plus and YouTube thing, the jury's still out on whether or not I'm gonna remove them entirely from my life, at least for that 30-day window. I don't know. Probably I will, just so that I ate the bugs. Honestly, just so that I can say I did it. Otherwise, I've kind of failed. Otherwise, I've pansied out, and I don't want to be a technological pansy.
It is also reassuring, I have to say, that you managed to cut Chrome OS and Google Android out of your life, which for most people, not necessarily a problem. But remind me who you work for again.
I work for SUSE.
You would think.
Everything I have is now running OpenSUSE, which honestly was kind of how I was pre-Google, you know? Then there was the Google OSs that slowly eroded away other service and piece of software in my life. It was crazy times. Anyway, wrap this up. I would like to hear what people think of this. And honestly, in particular, I would like to hear from people who have done this and what services they've used to get rid of other Google services in our forum, because people are interested in this. I'm getting an onslaught of emails and comments and everything from people, from companies that provide alternatives and whatnot. And this is proving to be a much, much bigger thing than I even realized. So I could use all the help and information that you guys have, because you guys are exactly the sort of people that will have likely done some of this stuff already. So if you have any thoughts on it, hop into the forum. Or if you just think I'm crazy, feel free to just talk about how you think this is a stupid idea. But that either way, it would be fun. So do that forum thing.
You're crazy. Yeah.
Thank God this show is over. This has been a long show. Before, ladies and gentlemen, listening at home, listening in your cars, wherever the hell you are listening, when we started planning today's show, we thought, oh, it'd be great to get someone awesome on from the government or something to talk about the surveillance topic that we talked about in the last episode. Of course, we couldn't figure out how to get a hold of anyone who A, would be pro-surveillance, so it would be interesting to talk to them, and B, would actually come on Bad Voltage.
Well, I was going to say, this time it wasn't actually that someone said no, like in times past. We just actually couldn't think of a single person to even ask. So we asked zero people.
I sent out emails to a bunch of politicians, but let's be clear, none of them were ever on any planet going to say yes to coming on Bad Voltage. I just felt like I needed to send an invite to somebody. I never even got a response, like not even like a boilerplate very interesting that you contacted us sort of response. I got nothing. So we thought this show is going to be so short. This is going to be the quickest show. Great, let's bang it out. And this show has already been on for what, 7 hours now? It's ridiculous. It's freaking ridiculous, and it needs to end.
Seems
right
like
now
forever.
Guys, tell the people what they need to know so that we can stop recording this stupid freaking show.
It does need to end right now, but you know what? Let's keep talking. More specifically, let's talk about Live Voltage, which is happening. We're going to be penetrating Germany and your ears and your eyes in Germany. So obviously, come along. It's on the 30th of September, 2015, which is Wednesday. That sounded pretty good, I thought.
This was a family-friendly show until that very moment. It's ridiculous.
I was talking about light and sound.
Yes, you were.
That's right.
So yes, come to Germany. People are already in Germany. You should go and see it, certainly. And there's
people that are even near Germany should be seeing it.
But if you're near Germany, you should be traveling to see it, right? We don't do this very often, the live show.
What town is it in?
It is in Fulda.
Fulda.
Which is a town that none of us had ever heard of.
Where is that at in Germany? Like, is that top or bottom, or where is that?
Yes.
It's in Germany.
It's near Frankfurt. Frankfurt's the closest major airport.
Yeah,
it's not in France.
It's not in France.
It's closer to Frankfurt than it is to Munich. End of German geographical knowledge, but nonetheless,
is it closer to like Cincinnati or closer to Cleveland?
Where's Cincinnati?
I'm not 100%
sure. South of Cleveland.
I don't know which country Cincinnati's in. It might be in Canada.
So the point we're trying to make here is if you go to badvoltage.org/live, is it just live? Just live. You'll find more or live.
Yeah,
either way.
That's what you're going to do. If you go to this event, you're going to live. You're going to feel what living is.
Bad Voltage!
You didn't know what it was like before.
I was going to say, you may argue that you didn't know what being alive was until you attended.
Colors are going to be brighter. You're going to see sound. It's going to be amazing.
There it is. Right. The beer will be colder.
Go to that show because of reasons.
Germany will win the World Cup again. Come to Bad Voltage Live.
And it's so go to badvoltage.org/live/live and just go and register. It's going to be €5 to get in, but we will have some free beer. And thank you to our friends in the Open NMS project, and specifically Taurus Baylog for making this whole thing happen. They're flying us out. They're taking care of the production costs for the show and all the rest of it. We're working on an awesome show. Unfortunately, Brian won't be able to join us because his kid's going to be born, but Brian will be part of the show, rest assured.
Yes,
I won't be there, but you know, there'll be a thing. I don't know what the thing is, but there'll be a thing.
Yeah, it's going to be rocking.
We're still working on the thing.
It will be rocking.
And to be clear as well, you don't have to, like, this is part of the Open NMS Users Conference. You don't have to be going to their conference to come to the show. So if you are going to the conference, definitely come to the show. But if you just want to come for the Bad Voltage show, you don't give a shit about Open NMS, then that's completely fine.
I'm sure there'll be one or two people who've gone to the Open NMS conference, don't give a shit about Bad Voltage, but presumably not that many. But you are welcome to come just to see Bad Voltage live.
Yeah. So come and check it out. Questions or question? What have we got?
So we did get one. We only got one question this time, didn't we?
Yeah.
I'll read it out. The first note is: if you have a question, send it in because we really are curious, and we will read it on the show. And this one was from Andrew, who said, "Why isn't Stuart armed to the teeth? He needs way more guns." I'll defer to you on that one, Eck.
Well, I think this came up because I was listening to the, you remember the gun control episode that we did, the gun control discussion that we had, and he seems to take a, I mean, it's difficult to take a more anti-gun view than I do, I admit it, but he takes a considerably more pro-gun view than I do. And I said, no, I don't believe there will be any of that. And his response directly to me on Twitter, only like yesterday or the day before or something, was... he said, well, but surely you would like a machine gun. Oh, yeah, there it is. Come on, man. You know you want machine guns. And I said, you know what? I don't. And he said,
you totally do.
And his response
though
was, of course you do, Rambo. So I fear.
What an argument.
I fear that I am. He and I are far enough apart on this particular subject that we may never meet in the middle. But, I mean. I have shotguns and it's quite fun.
Rambo 47, The Return of Aquarius.
There it is.
A Netflix smash, I'm sure.
I just
the age of Aquarius.
They're not for me.
I'm actually shocked, and I did not know that you had ever shot a gun. I figured you were so anti, because I believe some of us are hyperbolic at times on the show. When it comes to his anti-gun stance, he's not being hyperbolic. He really is that anti-gun.
Yeah, no, I really am.
So I'm actually shocked that you have even shot one. To be honest,
no. I've shot rifles here in the UK, and I shot a pistol in the US. We were at a canonical thing in Dallas. And we hired
not
a limo.
That it was in Texas.
We hired a limo and drove to a gun shooting range. I've never felt more like 50 Cent in my whole entire life. It was brilliant.
That's so awesome.
And then I ended up paired with George Castro. So we go up to the bar or whatever it's called, and the guy's like, "So, what weapon would you like, sir?" And I said, "Can I have a black one?" I see there's loads on the back there. That one looks cool. And George is like, "He'll have a 1932 or some bloody thing," which I didn't understand. And it turns out that I'm not very good at it, unsurprisingly.
Did they not make you just use a musket or something?
I thought, here's the thing, where maybe I turn out to be some kind of super brilliant marksman like the guy in Wanted, and it was sadly not the case. Yeah,
not the case.
They should have just handed you a billy club.
Right, seriously.
What's your views on like laser tag?
A laser tag's
fine.
Oh,
that's a good question.
I mean, it's full of annoying people.
Do you have an issue with people simulating shooting each other?
What about non-lethal projectiles like paintballs or something?
Having done paintball once, I found it to be really. Do you remember us doing paintball? I found it really, 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 really annoying. Laser tag's fine, but paintball just means you end up running about in a soaking wet wood for ages. I was bored out of my mind and went to the pub halfway through.
Yeah, we were doing paintball. The first Lug Radio Live, the second day we organized paintball, we thought it'd be brilliant. Mainly because the goal here was to shoot, that we're all going to gang up on John Masters and shoot him in his round head.
Who is now chief arm architect at Red Hat or whatever, which just goes to show you what being unfairly targeted by Lug Radio does for you.
And so we had this whole idea, and about 15, 20 of us went out to do paintball, and then basically Ack and I sloped off and went down the pub and had a couple of cups of tea, because we're weak.
Did you guys just take an awesome paintball story and end it with, we gave up halfway through and got some tea?
Yes.
This is ridiculous. We are 9 minutes into closing this show. I said 9 minutes ago this show needed to end, and now you're telling me a damn tea story? I'm pushing the stop button.
Yeah, what else do we have? Do we have anything left?
There's always room for tea.
Feedback. Yeah.
We did actually get after the surveillance discussion last time, we had an email. I mean, Jono, did we not have an email come in?
Hang on. Let me check the show notes. Yes, we did.
Good God.
Only the finest production value here.
I guess I should have read
this.
All right, here we go. So the email, because a certain co-host, Ack, didn't write who the email came from.
Yeah, he did. It's
who
at the
did
bottom.
It come from? Oh, Nige. Nige, is that it?
That's what it said. That's what the email said.
Nige. All right. So we have someone called Nigel who listens to the show. I'm not sure how I feel about that. It's all very well, the organizer of the Download Festival saying that all the surveillance data will be deleted after it's over. That's impossible for anybody outside the organization to verify. This opens up a wider issue regarding these rights to disappear or whatever they are called. So this is back to the Google. Is that the Google thing? Like the right to be...
Right to be forgotten.
Not right to be forgotten. Yeah. Every half-decent IT department will perform daily backups of data, deleting a record from a live data. Do I need to read all this? Can you summarize, Zach? I haven't read this. Well, and also, I'm the only person on the team who cannot read text off a screen.
His contention was that regardless of what the official policy said, current IT practices dictate that the data will probably live on somewhere, likely in a lot of places, and who will... in the end, have access to that is difficult to ascertain.
Yeah, which I think is to some extent a reasonable point. We were quite pleased in the discussion that the people doing facial recognition stuff at the Download Festival have said all the whole database will be deleted a week after the festival is done. His contention is, first of all, they might be lying about it, and secondly, that even if that happened, I bet that stuff all gets backed up everywhere, and who has access to the backups, and how do they make sure that it's all been completely cleaned? Can we trust them? Blah, blah, blah. And it's a reasonable point. I don't think we were necessarily credulously accepting it and thinking that everything was okay, but the fact that the discussion has moved from we're allowed to film you and do what we like with the data to we're allowed to film you but we will delete it is at least an attempt to respond to people's concerns about this, right? Yeah.
I guess this brings up that we actually did have two good interview opportunities. We could have got someone from Download or someone from the company they hired to do the surveillance.
Why didn't any of us think of contacting someone from Download?
Yeah, why didn't we think about that?
We are the most retarded co-hosts of any show ever.
We think about it at the end of the show.
We need to stop this before we make ourselves look even worse, guys. Wow. We're ending this awesome show on, boy, we forgot to do the most obvious thing possible, and then we had tea when we could have been cool. We seriously need to not do a show anymore today. It's so important.
I'd recommend anyone listen to this right now that you immediately unsubscribe from this podcast.
Absolutely. Although like, if you do that, then
you down. We are a bad influence.
Sometimes we refer to a previous show and think that was a really, really good show. This is not that show.
This show was awesome until 10 minutes ago.
I think that's terribly unfair because you're right. We should get someone from Download to comment on surveillance. So in the next show, commenting on mass surveillance and whether it's good or not, we will have the lead singer of Five Finger Death Punch, who will be in Download.
Believe me, he is not the guy to get on a podcast. That guy's a psycho, all right? Of all the bands you could have picked.
That's precisely why I picked them, because I don't think I'd know how Slipknot feel about this sort of thing.
Jeez.
Right.
All right. Yeah, so seriously, go and unsubscribe. Thank you, Nigel, by the way.
Don't just unsubscribe. Go onto Twitter and tell everyone, unsubscribe from @BadVoltage. Tell everyone on Twitter it is mandatory that they not only not tell anyone about this show, but that they tell everyone to stop listening to this show. Don't go to the website, badvoltage.org. No. Don't follow our account, the Plus Bad Voltage Google Plus account. Don't do any of that stuff. No. That is absolutely out of the question and unacceptable.
Yeah. Yep. In this case, we don't care about what your thoughts are, and we don't want you to go to community.badvoltage.org.
I want to see the hashtag no more bad voltage trending on Twitter by 2 days after this show getting out. I need to see that. Otherwise, I will have lost all faith in humanity.
But
what worries me is I'm starting to think that Brian actually thinks this is some kind of marketing masterstroke, right?
And by the way, if you do have questions, if you do have feedback, show@badvoltage.org is the place you want to send it.
Yes.
Once you've unsubscribed.
Fine note, I say we wrap it up, and as always, thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.